Tonight on Right to Be Heard, the Alaskan Gold Rush of 1898. Stick around.
You're listening to Michael Sargent's Right to Be Heard. Right to Be Heard.
In collaboration with the University of Louisville's Film and Media Department.
Only on turquoiseradio.com.
Hazlitt's Journal is a timeless story about a restless nation and the great American spirit upon which it was founded. It's a true American story, unedited, told in the journalist's original voice, now captured for generations to come. George Cheever Hazlitt, inspired by the great tycoons at the dawn of the Industrial Age, became one himself in the Chicory coffee market. But the markets crashed and coffee became as cheap as the dirt the farmers were trying to cultivate. In the midst of this calamitous financial crisis of the late 1890s, he turned to the one opportunity that played no favorites, the Klondike Gold Rush. And back with us this evening is John Clark, George Cheever Hazlitt's great-grandson. John, welcome back to Right to Be Heard.
Hey, Michael. It's good to be back. Thank you.
Well, I'm excited to bring you back because I'm excited to talk about your great-grandfather's journal, Hazlitt's Journal, by George Cheever Hazlitt. I think the story as it's told transcends time itself. And what I mean by that is his description of his struggles, the triumphs, the despair, the strength, the fears, all that laid open. I intend for this to be seen by anyone, I don't think, other than himself, maybe a few family members. I don't know. We'll have to get into that. But just the raw power of his ability to describe his circumstances, his surroundings, and the adventure that he found himself and others on during that period. It just transcends any place and in any time, and is a tale I think that will resonate with anyone that has faced struggles, has triumphed, and has soldiered on in spite of the odds, in spite of what others might say, and with a strong moral compass guiding them along the way. Anyone that can relate to a story like that can relate to Hazlitt's Journal. And again, welcome to the show, and I'd love to hear more about it. Can you tell me what circumstances? Now we read a little here about it, about the circumstances of his business, but what was going on with him and his family and the country at that time? That's kind of an extreme measure to take, to pack up and leave.
Yeah, I thoroughly agree. Let me just make one little statement here. You kind of reminded me. Yes, George Cheever Hazlett was my great-grandfather, but, you know, I never knew this man. And so I was really looking at it from kind of an out-of-body experience, really. I had no affection for him, really. He was just another person until, of course, he's my great-grandfather, and so he's part of my family. But this happened in 1898, and he died in 1926. So I never knew him, but I knew my grandfather, who was his son, and he didn't talk much about his father, other than he was raised in Valdez, Alaska, for a good part of his young life before he went off to college. But he told little bits of stories and never much, and not until I was in my 50s did I really get an understanding of who this man was, but I was really curious about how someone could leave their family and go off, you know, for months, years, actually, without their family around them. And so before we really kind of get into the story and the little bits of it, I'll get into that. I don't want to spoil the story for everybody, but I do think that understanding what was going on at the time. In the 1890s and a little bit before that, what was going on in the world or in the United States at that time is really kind of important because it matches up pretty well with some things maybe that even happened today. So, you know, briefly looking back, he was born October 11th, 1861, in Senecaville, Ohio. He was graduated from the Iowa State Normal School in Cedar Falls, Iowa, now called the University of Northern Iowa. He eventually located in Atkinson, Ohio, where he became superintendent of public schools there. Later, through the urging of family and friends, he entered politics and was elected county clerk of Holt County, which at the time included both clerk and auditor's duty, which was pretty responsible position for a young, strapping lad of 26 years of age. After serving two terms, he entered business and introduced, you mentioned the chicory business, which at the time was pretty innovative in terms of the concept that he had, where the federal government paid farmers to grow chicory, and he bought the chicory from the farmers and ground it up into a grind to blend with very expensive coffee at the time. You know, the coffee was very expensive during the Civil War and after. Because of the embargo in New Orleans, there was not much coffee got through. But for a long period of time, up until the 1890s, the coffee was very hard to come by. And so he had made this blend that he cut coffee to extend it, basically, so you could have a coffee beverage. But it would have chicory in it. He did a series of real estate deals with friends and associates. One ended up precariously with a friend by the name of Barrett Scott. Scott had been elected to the same Holt County Clerk's office after Hazlett's term. What is kind of weird or interesting about that, Barrett Scott was hung by vigilantes for embezzling about $90,000 from the Holt County Treasury and the taxpayers. That $90,000 today is worth about $2.5 million, or very nearly that much money.
So, wow.
You know, it's it's a bunch of money. This was a major story. It ran throughout the country. It even made the New York Times. Hazlett, an eventual partner in the Alaska venture, Andrew Jackson Mills, were implicated in a series of related lawsuits. All three of these men were Republicans at the time, and Republican is different than what's today. It's similar, but not. There's a different. If you all remember, Teddy Roosevelt was as a police commissioner during the 1890s, and then he eventually became, you know, president right after, I think, 1902 or something like that. But and that was the era of the new the new Republican, basically, which was more of a reform type of person. But this is kind of an interesting piece because at the time. The Republicans were in control of the territory there, and then a more progressive agrarian agenda was in play, and the populace became in control. And as was the practice, of course, at the time, any shortfall in budget from one office to the next in terms of the county treasury was just carried forward into the next term, you know, into the next person that was took. If you ran a second term, you just picked it up and you just kept on moving forward with it, and you accepted the shortfall. But when the political landscape changed, the populace wanted to hold the predecessor county clerk hold him accountable for the shortfall. And of course, Scott was man left holding the bag there. But he had done some things. I mean, he was playing a little bit of Robin Hood with friends. I mean, it was a terrible time in our history. There was a drought going on in the Midwest. Farmers were going bankrupt, and people needed help. And so there's kind of a controversy over whether or not. I mean, he was a bad man, but in the eyes of the populace, he was a bad man. So anyway, but eventually he was hung by vigilantes. You know, it'd be kind of interesting to see if our Washington leadership would hold by the same discipline, but I don't think that's going to happen, do you?
not in our lifetime.
So Scott was left holding the bag. The can could not be kicked down the road anymore. Hazlett and Mills quickly settled their shortfalls during this stint. They respectively had $10,000 and a $3,500 shortfall. And they were held accountable for that. So personally, they had to come up with the cash. They paid them off. Hazlett was able to. Mills, who had been county clerk earlier, he was just a raw dirt farmer and a cowboy. He didn't have much money, but he did have a ranch. So he had to put that up to pay off his debt. He nearly went bankrupt because of it. But you know, with their reputation somewhat tarnished in their certain political circles, the chicory business going out of business, coffee becoming too expensive, the country was in turmoil over this growing separation from the common worker and the large corporation trust that literally ran the company. There was a great panic of 1893, if those of you all understand your history, I know your history, which was the first really great recession. It was the deepest recession up to that point. Of course, 1939 was the other one, but that came years later. There was nothing to do for these guys, really. They had done just about all they could do in this territory of Nebraska, and so they needed to start a new life and, you know, basically get out of Dodge, I guess, to try to see what else they could do, as their fathers had done. Their fathers, you know, had moved west, just like a lot of people had done after the Civil War.
So the pioneer spirit was in their blood, yeah.
No question about it. I think it was across the country, especially in the Midwest. It was a challenging time and much unrest for the middle class. Some might say it mirrors what is going on today, as we've kind of mentioned. The growth of colossal corporations in the aftermath of the Civil War had produced immense consolidated wealth for business owners. The country was literally being run by a handful of very wealthy men. John D. Rockefeller, Standard Oil, J.P. Morgan, and Andrew Carnegie were running U.S. Steel, and there were others, but there are only about four or five people. I mean, probably more than half the wealth of the country was run by these guys, and these were all private enterprise folks. J.P. Morgan, in 1898, lent the U.S. government $62 million in gold to float a bond issue to restore the gold standard and the U.S. Treasury to raise it back up to $100 million surplus so they could operate and have some sort of a cushion. Morgan will play an important part in the lives of Hazlett and Mills later on. Lives of working people the Western farmers and the Eastern factory workers alike were becoming, their life was becoming increasingly difficult. The country was changing fast. The railroads were expanding quickly. The air was laced with telephone wires, and the new inventions, like the telephone, was starting to take place. Other inventions, which are interesting, seeming to be springing up all over the place, and scientific wonders like the phonograph, the incandescent light bulb, the moving picture, the radio. All this was were new and new inventions that were stimulating the country and the world at the time. The Industrial Revolution was on, yet it was not becoming easier for the masses to make a living. The steamship was replacing the sailing vessel ship. There were new railroad systems expanding with the government help in the name of progress. 70 new railroads were popping up all over the country in what was called what Alaskans like to call is the Lower 48. Development of the mass production techniques were sucking up jobs and traditionally traditionally were done by laborers. The meager wages for a 12-hour day in unsafe, unsanitary factories spurred millions of workers to join unions. It was a time of strikes and riots, pitting troops, U.S. troops, against the desperate worker. Businessmen were actually fearful of a coming revolution at this period of time. This is all during the 1890s. In 1886, just kind of a part of this, just predecessor to 1890, 600,000 workers were on strike, disrupting thousands of business and railroad lines. This unrest was in every newspaper or magazine across the country. By the 1890s, 4 million workers were out of work. The gulf between the employed and the employer was becoming wider and wider. The heralding age of plenty, these wonderful savings of time and labor and all these wonderful inventions served only to diminish the ability of the American to procure the goods they needed to sustain their families. So restless American pushed west with promises of free land and government under the Homestead Act signed into law by then President Lincoln to rebuild the country. So all these are all dynamics that were going on: the Homestead Act, the Civil War, the Industrial Revolution. Soon after that, this was the turmoil that was going on. There's a lot of positive things, but definitely a challenge, you know, for the Midwesterner in this period of time. So, but at the same time, there were stories all over newspapers worldwide. This was in 1896 that gold had been discovered in Alaska. In 1898, the Great Alaskan Gold Rush was on, and with many brave, fearless men and women, you know, faced toward the unknown Northwest, which was to become the last American frontier. There were probably over 100,000 people that planned and made it probably to Alaska, but only 30,000 of them would really make it and go into the Klondike, into the land of gold. So these two men, George Cheever Hazlett, age 37, married with two boys, and Andrew Jackson Mills, age 46, married, six children, banded together with the backing of family and friends and headed to Alaska to seek their fortune.
And against that backdrop, we're going to take a quick break. When we return, we're going to hear about the journey. And my conversation with John Clark will continue in just a moment. You're listening to Right to Be Heard on TRQTurquoiseRadio.com.